Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Poetry in motion. Turn a tender eye to me. Stingers in the ocean. Sweeter than any harmony. But you blinded me with silence.
She blinded me with silence.
Good morning.
Morning.
Saturday, the 21st of September 2024. Just in case you're listening on catch up, you're of course listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week. From 11 till 12, you've got Julian Paul here live in the studio, of course. If you tuned in earlier, Laveda's doing Soul Plus the hour before. We've swapped seats now. Mix it up a bit, how it is. This week and every third Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of, but also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. He'll be continuing the chat he started last month with Enhancing Your Photos, so he's going to be doing part two of that chat. Next week, all being well, it's Chris Dale. He's going to be talking about dairy allergies and junk food ad ban, which is very interesting. In fact, I'll talk about that now. Ministers have said they're open to a ban on children using social media. Oh, sorry, it's a different bit, isn't it? I thought it was a food bit. I'll come on to that later. It's just been one of those mornings. It is all live. It is all live. Anyway, later in this show, we've got RPG. And if you tune in regularly, you'll know he's talking about, guess what? Bits and pieces.
Yes, we can play it.
Before we get on to some nitty-gritty news, a quick reminder of two exhibitions that are really, really good local exhibitions, but they're finishing very soon. Firstly, Gresley, Genius of Steam and Speed. That's until... this Saturday, it finishes today. Oh, my word. So get there quick. It's a Danham Gallery in Doncaster. It's Danham Gallery, Library and Museum. Free entry. You can donate if you like. Sir Nigel Gresley, of course, if you didn't know, was famous for inventing the Mallard and the Flying Scotsman. I think they were built at Doncaster as well. Can you believe that? Also, a bit closer to home, Millennium Gallery in Sheffield on Arundel Gate. Show Your Metal, that's running until next Sunday, the 29th of September. Again, it's free, but you can donate. We went yesterday. It's very good. So yes, we'd recommend you go and pop in and see it.
There's a great video as well, as soon as you go in, showing a guy polishing metal, making it into sort of jewellery and other... Brilliant. It lasts 3 minutes. It's brilliant.
There's some of the great stuff there as
well. So, a city of invention and discovery, Sheffield and metal are synonymous. The city has an international reputation within the field of metallurgy, forged by its development of innovative new materials. Significant examples include invention of old Sheffield plate and Britannia metal in the 1700s, which made copies of fashionable software affordable to a greater number of people. Perhaps most notable of the city's contribution to steel manufacture, Benjamin Huntsman's invention of crucible steel in 1742 greatly increased the quality of production within Britain. Contributing to the Industrial Revolution, the Bessemer process became the first inexpensive means of mass production in 1858. And in 1913, the emergence of stainless steel changed the world, impacting industry, construction, transportation and domestic products. The city is ideally situated for metal production. Its steep hills provide fast-flowing rivers and access to raw materials, including ironstone, sandstone, limestone, clay and coal, which were all used in the early steel, cutlery and tool trades. Its surrounding woodland was also an asset, as wood was used to make charcoal, a fuel for making iron and an ingredient for steel.
Fascinating stuff, eh? So that's the Millennium Gallery until next Sunday, free, but you can donate. And on that note, Kelham Island's doing some great talks, the Hawley Collection. If you're interested in steel and cutlery manufacturing, check out their website, Kelham Island Museum. As I said, tried to say earlier on, I got quite a bit of a wrong thread there. I read something that said need to know. Ministers have said they're open to a ban on children using social media, as a government advisor warned that inappropriate content online could be driving a mental health crisis. Now, Peter Kyle, who was the Science and Technology Secretary, said he was looking very closely at a move by Australia to set a minimum age for children to access platforms such as TikTok and Snapchat. Wow. All interesting stuff. If you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. So it's September. Today the weather's a little bit different. Not quite the sunny weather that we had earlier this week. So have you got September sadness? Seasonal affective disorder starting early. What to do to beat it? Now this is an interesting one. End of summer blues affect more than a quarter of us, according to scientists. So what can you do to combat that? Well, it's all about your diet and a few other things. So let's have a listen at this then. The best fruit for a seasonal boost is the kiwi fruit. So adults aged between 19 and 64 need 40 milligrams of vitamin C a day, according to the NHS. In 2021, researchers at Milton Keynes University Hospital, NHS Foundation Trust, found that getting too little vitamin C is more prevalent than is generally known. Low intakes of vitamin C can leave you feeling tired, weak and irritable. Now, good sources of vitamin C include yellow or green peppers, black currants, cantaloupe, melon, broccoli and Brussels sprouts. But this article, I think this is amazing. It says, for a really swift acting boost, try eating two kiwi fruits every day. Not only will they meet your daily needs for vitamin C, researchers reporting in the British Journal of Nutrition last year suggest they could improve vitality and mood within just 1 week. So get out and buy some kiwi fruit. Now, problem's going to be is that they're probably not growing in this country. So they're probably going to be brought in from somewhere else. But that's another matter, isn't it? The other thing it says you can do to be September sadness, if you're feeling a bit blue after the summer's finished, eat more chia seeds and sardines for a dopamine hit. So healthy omega-3 fatty acids are found in abundance in seeds and fatty fish. including tin mackerel and sardines. There's lots of evidence that people with higher levels of omega-3 in their diet are less likely to suffer from mild depression and seasonal affective disorder. In Iceland, levels of seasonal affective disorder, also referred to as SAD, are relatively low, and some experts think this is due to the huge amount of oily fish they consume. Chia seeds and flax seeds are great if you don't eat animal produce as well, says Ellie Brecker, who's a registered nutritionist. Add one tablespoon of seeds to your porridge or salad. There you go. Also, another report says up your intake of leafy greens to support your brain. Jenna Macchioli, an immunologist at the University of Sussex, says that eating leafy greens rich in magnesium should be a priority at this time of year, as the mineral is important for immunity. Manganese insufficiency is rampant in the UK, and we should focus on eating foods that provide more of it, she says. Magnesium also supports neurotransmitters and promotes relaxation. Something also we've talked about quite a lot. Go outside for at least 5 minutes every day. Oh, twice a day. Every day. Probably the single most important thing you can do for your mood to boost it at this time of year is to get outside first thing in the morning and again in the late afternoon. That's according to Jennifer Wild, who's a consultant clinical psychologist and associate professor at the University of Oxford. In 2022, a groundbreaking study of 85,000 people published in Nature revealed astonishing improvements in rates of low mood and depression when participants had regular exposure to natural daylight. 5 minutes outdoors is enough if there are blue skies above. If it's overcast, a 10 to 15 minute walk will still help. All good stuff. Next up, start taking vitamin D now. So government advice is to pop a 10 microgram vitamin D supplement from October until March. That's when sunlight, which is the main source of the nutrient, diminishes. Psychiatrists from Taiwan, who reviewed 25 published papers for studying the journal Depression and Anxiety, concluded that vitamin D supplementation can reduce negative emotions, particularly in people with low levels of it to start with. Very interesting. Finally, just a handful of nuts can boost your mood. There's no better time than now to start adding nuts to your diet. A Spanish study published in the journal Clinical Nutrition found that a small handful, which is about 30 grams of nuts a day, which is roughly 10 walnuts or 20 almonds or 15 cashews, was associated with a 17% reduced risk of depression. So there you go.
The innocent can never last. Wake me up when September ends. Like my father's come to pass, 7 years has gone so fast. Wake me up when September ends. So rain again, falling from the stars, drenched in my pain again, become who we are. As my memory rests, but never forgets what I lost. Wake me up when September ends. When
we did when spring began. With the orange of temperance, it comes a rain again, falling from the stars, drenched in.
Great song there by Green Day, of course. Wake Me Up When September Ends. Have you got September sadness? Well, now you know a few things to do to try and combat it. Go and eat some kiwis, see how you feel. If you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, what an intro for your bits and pieces section. Especially for you.
Spoiled.
I know. Yeah. Can't be bad, can it?
No. You have to find a track, something like Scatterbrain. Or
there is one.
Well, there is Scatterbrain. It's Jeff Beck, isn't it? Yes. We'll have to find that out for another show. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, the first one's a bit of playing into September sadness, I guess. The results of the butterfly count. We told everybody to get involved, but apparently it's the lowest figures on record. Basically, the conservationists who are warning about a butterfly emergency. It's from the Big Butterfly Count, which is organised by a wildlife charity, Butterfly Conservation. It's taken over 3 weeks in the summer, and they asked people in public to spend 15 minutes recording butterflies in their garden. Well, I had a look, and I noticed that there were a lot less species and less actual numbers of butterflies. I think in my 15 minutes, I got two.
Well, same here. In fact, we've seen more butterflies in sort of last week or two than in the rest of the summer, which is really sad.
It is, yeah. And I think sort of nature's a bit confused with the cycles of weather we've been getting. But there are 9,000 counts were logged. I've seen no butterflies at all. That's the highest in the history of the count. And they said that it was the worst summer in count's history for butterflies, including the common and holly blues, green-veined and small whites, small tortoise shell, painted lady and Scotch Argus. Dr. Richard Fox, head of science at Butterfly Conservation, said that the declines were driven by the loss of habitat in the 70s and 80s as land was ploughed up or built on, and the ongoing degradation of the landscape since then, including pesticide pollution. So all the horrors that we know, I mean, they've written an open letter now to the Environment Secretary calling on the government to declare this as a nature emergency and ban nicotinide pesticides with no exceptions. And hopefully they said that butterflies are a key indicator and that this decline could mean that we are approaching trouble on a worldwide basis.
Yeah. Is it weather-based as well?
Yeah, it's there's a huge change. I mean, if you want a measure of the weather change, just look at Central Europe in the last week or so. Massive flooding, massive changes. And here, the switching weather some degree where rain's brought in, then we have a sunny break, and it just seems quite troubled weather.
But I mean, I read that butterfly count, butterflies are an indicator of wider biodiversity, aren't they? So if they're in trouble, but to be fair, Paul, I've not seen many bees this year, or wasps.
No, I think the thing that's doing best in my garden is spiders. Keep walking out in the morning and walking straight into some strings of a web that's gone up from the last time I walked out. So, lots and lots of spiders, less flies. We did have a rash of midges, I guess, for a very short spell. But they were biting, so ended up with a few spots from that. But butterfly-wise, I think in the previous year, we did quite well. But all of a sudden, massive downturn. So,
but that's why these surveys are useful, though, over time, isn't it, to see what the changes are? Because they do so, and you do that, take part, that even seeing nothing... you should still record it.
It's the thing where we can talk about missing species and things. We get the warnings and all of a sudden things disappear. But also, don't forget, nature does bounce back. So every so often we hear that a missing species has suddenly been found again. So it's... I think getting involved and trying to help monitor what's happening with the planet we're on is something we could all do. And, I think we only get one chance at a planet by the looks of it, so we should keep it. But I think the other thing that caught my eye is the news that there's an industrial revolution underway in low Earth orbit. LEO, LEO. And with the exploration of deep space, it's critical to advance our understanding of many of the questions about the universe. And I think that looking at the low Earth orbit, an article in the Washington Post said the most profound chapter in human history is the Industrial Revolution happening in low Earth orbit. And that's just 250 miles above our heads. So the article said we're at a turning point for our civilization, pivoting from 60 years of space exploration to a new era of unprecedented economic activity, manufacturing and growth in space. So the burgeoning epoch is called the orbital age, and it'll drive a new trillion-dollar industry, they say. They say we're on the cusp of a full commercialization of space. So we've seen a commercial spacewalk in the last week or so, where four people went up on a private spacecraft and managed to get out and walk in space. I think first governmental sponsored visit to space and spacewalk. So things are happening up there, and we've talked about it before. The Starlink pattern of satellites is launched in low Earth orbit, and it's put there the whole ethos behind Starlink is to spread connectivity on the internet to inaccessible places around the world. And I think in the UK, where there are still some inaccessible places, if you want to get onto Starlink, it costs you about £500-600 for the connecting station on Earth, and I think the subscription's about just short of £90 a month for high-speed connection. But what it does mean to achieve that, there are already several thousand micro-satellites as part of Starlink, but it looks like there could be anything like 10 to 11,000 of these satellites. And one of the things that was picked up very early on, I think, from our film people, is that these things initially were very reflective, so they made a mess if you were trying to observe the night skies. You've got all these weird spots of light crossing your field of view as they rotate around the Earth. And I think that's now been exacerbated by a lot of the radio astronomers who look into deep, deep space, and they're looking at things like black holes, the flares in black holes. But the proliferation of electronic signals through this mesh of satellites is starting to interfere with the radio telescopes. So it might be an industrialization of space and a move forward, but it could also be a setback to science. And our understanding of the universe, the cosmos, and everything else. So what they're saying is that biotech firms, pharmaceutical manufacturers, makers of semiconductors, and other advanced materials will start to invent and produce breakthrough products that will benefit our life on Earth, but within microgravity factories in space.
Wow.
Yeah. Whoa. So the aerospace is building the infrastructure, and the end-to-end business and technology platform will accelerate this new space economy, said the article.
Very interesting.
It's crucial for businesses. So nowadays, businesses are being urged to have a space plan. So it's incredible, isn't it? But there's a Dream Chaser space plane that's going to launch the International Space Station soon. And an expandable space station technology has been successfully completing key milestone tests at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, and can be in orbit in 3 years. Again, we saw the news that SpaceX is going to get the contract for destroying the old space station and taking it out of orbit. So we talked about possibilities of cleaning up space, because there are now lots of defunct satellites that are floating around in orbit that really are taking space and blocking sort of vision from Earth. So we need to get on to that side of things. But LEO is a term that I'm sure we're going to come up with a lot more sort of news about. It's from the 1990s on board a NASA platform in low Earth orbit, which they call the Wake Shield facility. Houston University manufactured a semiconductor in the vacuum of space that was 10,000 times better in quality than the ones made on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, bioengineers used a 3D printer to create a two-chambered structure of an infant's heart from stem cells during a parabolic flight that simulated weightlessness. So it says the orbital fabrication will unlock billions of dollars in value for companies, particularly drug makers.
Wow, LEO then. That's a word. Yeah. I've not heard that before, Paul. So
yeah, so I think it's one that's going to be on our agenda more and more in sort of present times. So interesting news from space, but also, I mean, talking about LEO, news for cats. So along with a cute picture, cats in hats are helping pain research.
Oh.
Yeah. So over a long period, researchers have been using brain scans to understand how felines can feel pain. But initially found that they had to be wired with electrode wires. And the cat's answer to that was to chew the wires.
Yeah, no thanks.
So the answer they found is to incorporate the sensors into a comfy crocheted beanie hat.
Oh, lovely.
So now that's a lot more pain-free and actually monitoring the pain, that it would now pick up and use the sensory stimulation. Try and identify a sensory stimulant that they can use to reduce pain. So again, it sounds cutey because it's within cats, but it's also something that's being pursued within human beings. Is can we control pain without drugs? and use things like electrical stimulus. And I've been involved in one or two things where using things, and we've probably all heard now about pacemakers fitted to control the regularity of your heartbeat. But there are other conditions. One that I got involved in was dystonia. And that's a problem where a sort of nervous complaint, and people start to lose the ability to stand upright, to walk and talk. And you can implant an electrode into the body and a stimulator which sends an electrical current and can have massive effects for those people to improve their lives. Parkinson's disease, potentially there's an electrical stimulant that can help sufferers with that. So cute cats in hats is lovely, and it's a great picture that goes along with it. Thanks to the iPaper for a small article. And I think that it is one of those things now. In space, we're going to be looking at new technology. On Earth, we're chasing things up. And I'll dash off in a bit, but also looking back over our shoulders, apparently a lot of extra research has been gone into trying to find the origins of COVID-19, and it was linked to the Hunan animal market and fish market, and China's always staunchly defended the sort of theories that said it was a leak from one of their laboratories. And most of the people now are coming to a consensus that there are a range of species that would have been on sale in the live animal market, and that's things like civets, civet cats, and palm rats. So they're actually looking at the gene of that original COVID-19 strain and looking at its transformation through different moves to try and backtrack, but they're close but can't actually put a final link in place at the moment. But again, cats have been involved in there, and it's going back in time because they were there because they're actually a foodstuff.
Yeah.
So, we can be very careful. I mean, we've had lots of things, I think, problems with bushmeat. So some African countries, people still get various animals that they catch in the bush, and the meat can contain all sorts of things. And we've seen the outbreak of Mpox, the monkeypox as it used to be called. That's expanding. I think we've got to be careful what we eat. And the final closer on that is food allergies. If you've got a peanut allergy, warnings are coming out now to say be very, very careful about anything that contains mustard, because through the processing or through some of the other things, mustard involved as an ingredient in other things is finding a trace peanut sort of contamination.
All good stuff, Paul. Before you go, then, a tiny soundbite I read yesterday, the new five a day.
Yeah.
Whole grains, legumes, yeah, which is pulses and dried lentils, things like that, fresh, yeah, whole fruit, nuts and seeds, omega-3, fats, and that's it. Eat those foods every day and you will immediately be eating more healthily.
Well, I must admit, I'm a bit of a nutter, so...
Ooh. Brilliant, Paul. And on that note, bye-bye, Paul. We shall speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show 1-3.
Cheers.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
So tell me, what's really news? After all, the king excuse me, your news has dead.
Bit of Green Slade there, Newsworth, because we weren't sure quite what Paul was going to talk about. But anyway, if you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. It's time for our guest speaker, Gareth Morgan.
I am a camera.
Morning, Gareth.
Morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very good, yes.
Do you know
fine.
What? You always have the most fantastic phone signal, so I don't know where you sit.
But near a window.
Near a window, that's it. Yes. Brilliant, because it's very difficult to know when you're on a mobile phone, but you're always absolutely loud and clear. So for people who don't know who you are a member of, but also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
Yes,
all good
indeed.
Stuff. One of the oldest, isn't it?
It is in the world.
In the world, amazing, good old Sheffield. So last time we spoke, you were talking about how to enhance your photos, but we got into quite a lot of detail. So you're gonna continue to talk about that.
Yes, I thought we'd try and finish off, because what I was talking about was enhancing images by concentrating on the basics, really, and getting those right. And we'd gone through aperture and shutter speed and things like that. I think we went to talking about getting the focus right. So I may repeat a little bit of what I said now, but I think it's an important area, because if a photograph is not in focus, it's useless, really.
Yeah. A lot of people, one of my pet hates on social media is people put photographs up and they're blurred, and you think, well, can't you tell it's blurred?
unless it's artistic. Mm. And sometimes you get people who take a blurry photograph and they turn it black and white and add a bit of grain and call it creative. It's nonsense. I mean, it's just a bad photograph. But anyway, so in terms of getting good photographs, I mean, I think most people use autofocus on their cameras. And that makes a lot of sense. Even professional photographers mainly use autofocus, to be honest. Most cameras give you the choice of manual or autofocusing. And you'd only use manual in specific conditions. It's much faster and easier to let the camera do it. Having said that, there are various options within it. I mean, these days, probably too many options. Cameras now come with eye tracking, motion capture, differential focus, you know, all these fancy things. I'm not going to talk about those today. I'm just going to talk about the basic autofocus functions and how it helps to understand what your camera can do. So most cameras, I think you'll find, will have a range of autofocus options. Sometimes it's only two or three. Sometimes I think mine's got nine different settings. And generally it's set for a kind of average focus where most of the scene is in focus. If you look at the back of your camera, either on a screen or through the viewfinder, and look at the focus setup, you'll often find there's a series of dots in a rectangular format. It may be 9 dots, it may be 5, it may be 27 is, I think, what the maximum on mine. And what that means is that all of those dots contribute to the focus that you're focusing on, or the subject you're focusing on. A lot of them are sort of center weighted, so the dot in the middle carries more weight than the dots around the edges, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And it's understanding when to use which of those. If you're doing a landscape and you want a lot of the area in focus, there's no particular subject you want to focus in on, use the widest setup, so as many dots as possible, and that gives you the maximum range of elements that are in focus, if you like.
Oh, right. Wow.
However, if you're photographing, let's say, a blue tit on a branch, you want to focus on the blue tit, and the blue tit is a very small bird. So most cameras have what's called a central point. That's just one point on your camera that you can use to focus on something small within the overall frame, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And often, I mean, on my camera, it's a bright red dot, and you can use, there's a wheel function on the back, sometimes on the top of the camera. You can move it around whilst looking through the viewfinder to settle on the subject you're focusing on. So it's important when you're taking a picture, and I think this is where a lot of the blurry photos happen. Your eye looks at somebody stood against a busy background, and you see that person in focus. If your camera is set up on general focus, it'll focus on the background as much as the person stood in front of you.
I see, yeah.
So that's why you quite often get things, and it's annoying because sometimes the background is sharp, but the one thing you really want to look at is blurred, and that's so annoying. I mean, that just... So it's important to, you know, if you're focusing on something really small, use a single point of focus. If you're focusing on a more general thing, use one of the other modes. And it's worth just going through your camera and seeing what your autofocus modes are. Because when you start, it'll be set up on general. So you might have to play about with it to get the one you want. So that's one way to help. I mean, it's not infallible. It still gets fooled. Because one of the things about these focus points is they rely on contrast. So if you point at a black wall, you know, the famous thing of a black cat in a black room, you know, the camera will struggle to find it. You're looking for an edge on something to give you a contrast.
Yes.
So, you know, so you find it all the time. Even in studios, you find you've got a white background. It won't focus on that at all. My camera needs something, and it can be quite small. It can be as small as, you know, someone's eye on a very pale face. That's all you need, a tiny bit of something for the camera to lock into.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I ran into it last week. We were at a workshop for a studio workshop called Sparkle. It was meant to be about capturing like light all over the place. We had a model in a dress made of like little silver diamonds and a background made out of two huge pieces of silver foil.
Oh.
We put a red and blue light on the background and flashing light on the dress and a white light on her face.
Wow.
Thinking, you know, we get a natural look on the face and everything else would be fantastic. It was an absolute devil to get to focus because there was so much light flashing around that, you know, you try to focus on the face and a beam of red light would come from somewhere. My autofocus just gave up in the end. So I had to switch to manual focus, getting a focus on the model's face and sticking with that and then letting everything else happen. Of course, the annoying thing was the model kept moving, so I had to redo it. But anyway, that's another story.
Wow.
But that's the fun and games you can have with
your club does get up to some interesting experiments, I have to say. You know, just going back to that thing about black and white and you need something a contrast. We watched an old film. It was Jane Eyre, I think, 1943, with Orson Welles? It was Orson Welles. And the photography, Gareth, was unbelievable, the way they used the light to capture his. It would all be dark and you could barely tell what was happening, but they'd shine a light just on one of his eyes. Yeah. And it was like incredible. Well, I thought so.
Yeah, no, I mean, those cinematic effects are fantastic.
The old ones,
But those cameras, I mean, they are fantastic at focusing on a single point of light, and it picks out the difference between it's the edge between the black and the white.
That's what's made me think of it, because I thought, because it's such an old film and the techniques they were using were just, the way they used light was incredible.
Yeah. Well, that's why I like black and white, because it simplifies the image and it tells a story. I always find black and white images carry more emotion than a colour picture.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's true, but to me, it always tells more of a story.
And
if you're looking at colour or picture, it's often the colours that dominate your thinking. Black and white is all about shape and dynamism and the feel of the photograph, I think.
And it's timeless. I think it's timeless. It makes everything blend into, everything else.
Yeah, well, I mean, I still do a huge amount of black and white. It's sort of, I think it's my go-to. Really.
So the red, blue, and the sparkles and the foil and all that was not really your sort of thing then?
Well, it was interesting. I have to say I was looking at them this morning and starting to process some. I'm not blown away with any of them because it's just not quite come off for me. But
did it come off for other people who were involved in that?
I think some people got, I think the different angles they got. They're happy with. Of course, it depends what you like. It's all a bit soft for me because the light was so strong. The model isn't really standing out, and I like crisp. Crisp images,
no, but it's all interesting. It's all about what you're focusing on, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's crucial. So that's the other thing. I mean, you've got your aperture, you've got the speed, and now you've got your focus. The final thing I was going to talk about is a thing called balance, white balance, which, again, most cameras allow you to play about with that. And what that's looking at is the color temperature of the light you're looking at. And I'm not sure if people realize that light has a temperature. I mean, not in terms of heat, but that's the way you measure candelas or whatever measures. The different sources of light give you a different light temperature. And that affects, I mean, it used to really affect film photography, but it still affects digital. So if you take a photograph in bright sunshine, that's at a heat of about 5,800 K. I'm getting a bit technical.
Oh, no, that's fine. No, go on. Go for it. Go for it. Yeah. So, yeah, what does K mean, 500K?
Well, I think candelas or Kelvin.
Oh,
I can't remember now. But anyway, it's a measure of the temperature of light. If you use tungsten or a bright spotlight, it can be much higher or much lower. And that's why people often, they'll take some photographs. Classic example is at a wedding. You take loads of photographs outside and they're nice natural light. You take a few inside and they look really funny. They're either a bluish tinge to them or it might be an orange tinge. And it depends on the light that's being used inside. It might be a fluorescent light has a different color. It might have a tungsten tone to it. That's different. You can get a difference between a bright sunny day and a cloudy day. And I like cloudy days because that's the most neutral and sort of the best light for photography purposes.
Does that have a lower color temperature then?
Yes, it's slightly lower. So, and that's why you'll find, even on small point and shoot cameras, you'll often find an option for your color balance or your light balance. And you can set it to sunny day, cloudy day, indoors, outdoors, tungsten lighting, spot lighting, whatever. And it's worth just understanding that, because then you won't get surprised when your photographs come back with a funny tinge to them.
Wow. I didn't know about that. I've sort of, when you can put effects on photos that you take on your camera often gives you filters and things, and you can adjust the reds, red, green, and blue, yeah. and it sometimes yeah. calls it the temperature.
Yes.
But whether
well, colours.
Yeah.
Colours. I'm getting into a whole area, even I don't fully understand, but colours have their own temperature as well, which is, I mean, red is hotter than blue, for example, which sounds obvious, but it kind of is. And you can fix, if you do it wrong, you can fix it in editing, but why bother if you get it right in the start?
You get it right in the first.
Yeah, so it's worth just thinking about it. It is something that, because it's the last thing, you know, I forget about it quite often, because on a long list of things you have to remember, it's near the bottom. But it does make a difference.
So what would your normal, what would a normal setting be for your balance then? You're saying particularly about white.
I set mine for what's known as 18% grey on a cloudy day. So most photographers, certainly serious photographers, will have what's known as a grey card. And that is, it's a shade of grey that's known as 18%. That's a kind of nice light grey, very neutral. And if you hold that up in nice normal daylight, that's the sort of medium setting for all cameras. That's wow. the best. And of course, because if you go 100% grey, you've got black. It's sort of, you know, and if you go 0%, you get to white. And that's why it's a good position to start from.
Brilliant. Wow. All these things you learn. So any more top tips?
I don't think so. I mean, join a camera club.
Yes, well, join. What about joining your camera club? SheffieldPhotoSociety.org.
Yeah, we've just started up again. We've got some new members.
Oh, brilliant.
Trying to get them involved. We've had some good speakers so far.
Fantastic.
We've got an exhibition coming up in November.
Aha, where's
at
that?
At the Winter Gardens in Sheffield.
Brilliant.
It could be the usual perspective, so a mix of different types of.
So this is where you choose, your members
yes.
choose what you want to
yes.
display. But do people decide what goes in?
Yeah, they just pick their own images, and we don't stop. You know, we let anything go in as long as it's not. How can I put it? Indecent, to put it that way.
Oh, yeah. So are you putting some in, black and white ones?
I will be, yes. I will probably.
I'll
probably put some black and white ones in, but I haven't finally decided, but I think I'm going to go for a theme this year slightly unusual. I won't say any more. You'll have to come and see.
Yeah,
it.
We will indeed. So when does that run from until? Do you know?
I think it's the beginning November.
You'll have to let me know the details. I'm sure if people follow your page on Facebook, it'll come up as an advert. But
yeah.
We've been to quite a few over the years, and the variety of subjects is amazing, isn't it? Because
yeah.
everybody's got their own personal, you know, things they really enjoy.
You get everything from, you know, nature, wildlife, landscapes to the weird and wonderful. It's
fantastic. It's a nice venue in the Winter Gardens as well.
Light's great in there. It's a really good venue.
Fantastic. And before you go, Gareth, you need to plug your talks at Kelham Island.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, because you're doing, I mean, we're going to one in November, which is about the three cutlery manufacturers. But I did look at the December one, and I believe you're doing that talk. But we're away, I'm afraid. I think it's the 4th of December,
yeah.
isn't it? Wednesday the 4th. And what are you talking about?
I'm talking about Stanley Tools, the history of Stanley Tools.
Amazing. Have you been to see the Show Your Metal exhibition in the Millennium Gallery?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
It's very good, isn't it?
It's very good.
And I'm sure there was something about Stanley Tools in there. Maybe one of the pictures of the...
Yeah.
Old building. There's a lot of artwork, isn't there, showing the old businesses?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of what I'll be talking about, is kind of how it started up in Sheffield. And Sheffield used to be known as the home of Stanley Tools.
It did.
Even though it's an American company.
You might have to come and do a talk on that for the science show as well. Because we'll miss it in December. So,
I'll reprise it.
Yeah. Brilliant. All right. Fantastic stuff, Gareth, as always. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks all.
Bye.
Bye.
You Better You Bet by The Who, when we played that, because we were talking to Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, about enhancing your photos. All exciting stuff. We are fast coming to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We've just got chance to do a very quick update of the our environment update. We should have done it earlier on and we've run out of time. It's been one of those days today. First up, Peter Wildcamp. There is a battle raging in the fields, forests and courtrooms of Britain over the right to roam. Some people believe they should have the freedom to walk and camp wherever they like, while others disagree, and those who disagree are the landowners and farmers who already have trouble dealing with litter, disturbed livestock and damaged habitats. There may, however, be a middle way, a scheme in which outdoor lovers pay to camp in wild spaces. Watch this space. Next up, forever chemicals polluting up to 10,000 sites. As many as 10,000 sites across England are contaminated with forever chemicals that pose a risk to human health and wildlife. An unpublished government report has found this document, which was obtained by a leading newspaper, we won't mention which, warns that cleaning up polluted land at fire stations, sewage treatment works, landfills and other facilities could cost £120 billion in a worst-case scenario. Oh, my word. Next one that I found very interesting, and I've read quite a bit about this, building sponge cities to beat the rain. We live in a wet country and it is getting wetter. But the more our concrete cities expand, all that water has fewer places to go. The answer may be building sponge cities. From permeable paving to green roofs, there are many ways to make Britain more flood resilient. Some places actually across the country are giving residents grants to remove their hard standings and astroturf lawns and actually take it back to nature and soil, which can absorb rain. All interesting stuff. What else shall we talk about? Let's see, we've got 2 minutes left, folks. Summits, www.phys.org, has a roundup of the main United Nations conferences that will take place over the next few months. First up is the 16th Biodiversity Conference of the Parties, or COP for short, which is being held in Colombia in late October, at which countries will look to transform global targets to protect at least 30% of the natural world by 2030 into concrete action. Then, of course, there is the 29th Climate Change Conference of the Parties coming up, controversially being held this year in oil-rich Azerbaijan. So where disagreements are expected around climate finance and the fossil fuel phase-outs are expected to dominate proceedings. There are also two smaller conferences focused on the issues of plastic pollution and desertification. My words. And I think that's it for us now. We're going to have to let the film show get on with it. Yes. You're talking about Threads, I believe. A little bit, yeah. 40 years anniversary filmed in Sheffield, was it?